Thank you. So we're going to take a little break from some of the great programmatic talks that we've had so far. They're looking at community-based strategies and how they impact health behaviors and health outcomes. We're going to delve in a little bit more deeper into that black box of how do community-based strategies have an impact on health behaviors and health outcomes. And part of what I believe that is, and it's kind of starting a common language together between the academic world and the NGO sector, and I think you'll probably see this coming up in a lot of the talks that you've gone to about community-based strategies, but to try and understand what is really happening to make certain communities really thrive in particular environments and very resource-poor environments, and how does that have an implication on health outcomes. And social capital is one key to get there. It's not the only, but that's what we're going to look at and unpack that a little bit and point to some future research implications for that. So I have no relationships to close. And we're going to start with a sort of a big overview. Most of you know that child mortality has fallen by more than a third. In fact, I think there are 6 countries that have reached the Millennium Development Goal for child mortality, reducing child mortality. But we're still off target. In Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, a lot of kids are still dying of preventable causes. And the same is true for maternal mortality. We see a lot of disparities, specifically with a high number of maternal deaths happening in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. But it's not just between regions or even between countries, but it's within those countries that you see a gap in those who are not well off, those who are poor and less educated, and those who are well off. And if you don't reduce those disparities in health outcomes at the country level, you're really not going to be able to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. So it's trying to understand how do we reduce those disparities. And why are there disparities? And there are a lot of reasons why, but we're going to focus on what a lot of the talks today have focused on is this idea of community involvement, community-based development. And health programs commonly lack community involvement and participation, and that's a lot of reasons why you don't see them sustaining health outcomes, because an organization moves in, huge influx of money, you see a short-term improvement in health outcomes, but nothing lasts. But there are programs, as you've heard today and a lot of the other sessions, that are addressing this. They're involving communities in planning, implementation, and management of health and development. And there's interest and investment in this strategy of community-based development. It's growing. World Bank is really heavily investing in this, and there are other multilateral and bilateral organizations are doing this. But the link between that developmental approach and maternal and child health outcomes is still unclear. So what is really happening in these communities? And it's clear from the presentations that we've heard so far is that these strategies can create that enabling environment to support healthy behaviors. But what is an enabling environment? What are the key components? How do we measure that? What is it called? And that's where we get into this term of social capital, and has been cited as sort of the missing link to that relationship between community-based development and healthy behaviors. So that's sort of where we're going. What is social capital? We heard a little bit from Amanda. It's a similar definition here. We're talking about social relationships, networks, and values that facilitate collective action for mutual benefit. So it's not just about who you're connected to or the support you receive from them, but it's about investing in those relationships as a form of capital, and then in the resources that are embedded within those relationships and being able to access those not only as an individual but for your household and your community to benefit your community as a whole. I'm going to talk a little bit about theory here, just so we're all on the same page. Amanda went into this a little bit, but a lot of theory on social capital is really dichotomized into what is called structural social capital and cognitive social capital. And this is part of getting onto that sort of common language. Structural social capital is another term for it is network social capital. So you're talking about sort of observable, objective behaviors of what people are doing. So this we're talking about going to a PDQ meeting. You know, you're actively involved in your community. You're a member of an organization, and it's looking at the roles that you play in that organization. Political involvement, social networks, are you connected to a doctor or a teacher or a government official? Looking at those things that are sort of observable and structural in your relationships. Whereas cognitive social capital is more about how you feel about your community, which is also critically important. And it's a little bit more subjective. So you're talking about do you have a sense of community? Do you feel like you belong to your community? Do people generally get along? Which is really important for health outcomes, as we've heard a lot about. It's also looking at collective action. Would you put aside your own self-interest to act on behalf of your community? And we're hearing a lot about that as well. So these two really are not separate. They need to be measured together. I'm not going to go into the second one because Amanda did a wonderful job of talking about bonding and bridging social capital. But it's another way to think about it. It's sort of a piece of that structural component. And bonding, again, you're talking about strong relationships with people with a similar social identity. Whereas bridging, you're looking at more of a heterogeneous group of people where maybe they are not necessarily all the same. So you might look at like religious or caste groups as being more of a bonding social capital, whereas you reach across some of these social identities and you're actually connecting with people who aren't like you, that's more bridging. And then the linking is a part of bridging where you're actually reaching across the power hierarchy in your situation, and maybe you're getting access to power and resources you may not normally have. And it's also important to think about, is this an individual attribute? Is this something that only individuals have, or is this something that actually impacts the entire community at a collective level? And so we're going to talk a little bit about both of those as we review these studies. So why is this important to look at in the developing world? Well, one, there is a lot of literature that supports that social capital is linked to lower levels of mortality and better self-rated health, so it is important. It also can be used by the poor as a means to protect against risk and vulnerability, especially for those who do not have access to human and financial capital. And again, as I said, it potentially is a missing link between community-based development, what we're doing practically, what are the inputs, and those health behaviors. And lastly, there's really a lack of evidence coming out of developing countries, especially the poorest countries in the world. Just going to show you this quick graph from a chapter in Social Capital and Health by Kawachi and colleagues. So you see over the past 15 years, there's a lot of research on social capital and health. It's really growing. But as you look at where those studies take place, these red dots are the least developed countries, and really nothing happened until about 2005. You see a small uptick, and it's increased a little bit, but proportionately, we just don't see this happening a lot. It's a critical issue in developing countries, a critical resource that I think should be studied. So the aims of this particular study, and I didn't mention this yet, but this just came out in the Journal of Global Public Health. It is online in the online program. You can access it there. I'll give you the citation, but just last week this article was published. But the aims of the article were to really review the studies on social capital and health in the least developed countries and then suggest where do we go from here, because it's important. There's just not enough out there right now. So what I did is I looked at three databases between 1990 and 2011, looking at social capital in the 48 least developed countries. Found 92 abstracts, but only 14 were included because either they were not empirical in nature, there may be a review article, the outcome of interest was not related to health, maybe it was agriculture, education, or something, or the study did not attempt to even measure social capital at all. They just like to use the word. So that's why we only ended up with those 14. So just quickly, most of them took place in Africa. You can see that level of attribution, most people talk about it in the individual level, and we'll talk about why that is at the end. And then most use this framework of the structural cognitive in their measurement of it. There's not a lot of this bonding, bridging, and linking, which is, I think, an important framework to be using, and we'll talk more about that at the very end, too. So I'm just going to quickly kind of go over these. I can't go over it in detail, but again, you can get the detail in the article that I just mentioned. Just to give you a snapshot of what people are measuring, what are they looking at. So we have sexual health, we have HIV and other infectious diseases, maternal and child health, and then we'll talk a little bit about self-rated health. Most articles are in sexual health, or 6 out of the 14 were on this particular topic. And they found that low bonding capital was associated with lower use of condom with a new partner. So that's a lower amount of connections with your friends, people who are like you, but a lower amount of bridging capital, which is connections with people that maybe aren't in your normal peer group, is associated with a high number of sexual partners, which is sort of an interesting finding. In another study in Ethiopia, they found that social exclusion, which is kind of the opposite of social capital, where you're not connected with people, is associated with coerced sexual initiation. And in another study in Uganda, they actually used the multi-level framework, so they looked at the individual and contextual level. Individual level, they didn't find anything, but at the contextual level, they found that this idea of cognitive social capital, or trust, was associated with lower use of family planning methods. So there's really mixed results. This is kind of interesting. We can talk more about why that might be. It wasn't significant, but there's something going on there. This study by Jamba looked both in Zambia and the DRC And there's two studies here that are very similar, using a sort of a unique way to measure social capital, which is based on James Coleman's theory of social capital, which is looking at the number of children in households. I wouldn't say it's a strong indicator, and it's not very commonly used. But the idea is that if there's more kids in the household, each individual child gets less attention, therefore they may be more prone to risky sexual activity. Found that in one country, and that was in DRC, but not in Zambia. So again, mixed results. A qualitative study by Larson actually looked at the practice of labia elongation, a communal practice, which is a traditional practice. What's interesting here, we see that actually enforced social norms and strengthened social ties. So you see a traditional practice that is actually increasing social capital, but can have very negative consequences for those girls who do not want to be a part of that. So it's again, something to think about as far as social capital is concerned. When we look at HIV and other infectious diseases, again, a lot of these studies, you can't really determine causality, and they go the other way. So here we see in Tanzania that social capital is more pronounced in villages with higher medium HIV prevalence rates compared to those with low rates. And what's happening here is those that experience a high prevalence of HIV are responding to that by forming organizations, forming support groups to address that increased prevalence. So you can't really determine causality here, because here you see more social capital in those with higher HIV prevalence rates. Maybe if you looked over time, you'd be able to see a reduction with those communities that had higher levels of social capital. Social capital also expanded access to networks and empowered vulnerable groups to safe behaviors. In another study, we found that social capital is a critical resource for supporting adherence to HIV treatment and also managing the economic hardship that comes from being HIV positive. And the last study in Bangladesh, they found with diarrheal disease that social capital improved self-care treatment, so using appropriate treatment like oral rehydration solution. Couple studies in maternal and child health that were really well done. This one in Ethiopia, actually they looked at four countries. The only one that was in the least developed countries was Ethiopia. They found that cognitive social capital was associated with higher height for age and weight for age Z-scores. So there is something going on. This is looking at maternal social capital for mothers, kids. And in another study in Ethiopia, they found low social capital, both structural and cognitive, associated with higher child mortality. So again, we're seeing that evidence building that something's going on here with social capital and its effect on health. Lastly, this is the last slide to go through these studies. In Bangladesh, for self-rated health, you see low levels of individual and community-level social capital associated with poor quality of life. You see, again, happening at both of these different levels. And then this article is really interesting. It's very sophisticated methods to look at social capitals measured by collective action and social networks and their association with improved self-rated health. So I'm sorry I went through those so quick. I just want to give you sort of a snapshot of all the different types of studies, but there's very few. There's only 14 in these least developed countries. The general observations that can be made from these four studies is, number one, social exclusion or the lack of social capital is associated with risky sexual behaviors. Participation in social groups had a positive effect on social norms related to sexual behaviors. So it's not only about being a part of a group, but it's about the norms that are within that group, because social capital can have negative effects. If the social norm is to not use healthcare or to do something that may be harmful, then that would be, obviously, if you have high social capital and a harmful norm, it could be propagated. So you have to be careful with it. Measures of cognitive social capital are associated with increases in nutrition and decreases in mortality. And lastly, higher levels of cognitive and structural social capital are associated with improvements in self-rated health. So where do we go from here? This is my last sort of pitch. So if people are interested in this topic of social capital and health, I would urge you to explore some of these areas. And first is defining the meaning and examine the operationalization of social capital in the developing country context. A lot of the theory has been built on in the industrial country context, and we really need to think about what does this mean in developing countries, maybe using the framework like the bonding, bridging, and linking capital framework, which I think can be very powerful in these settings, and developing that sort of literature and then getting it out there so that people can build on that, on what's happening. So it's, yeah, and the next part is builds on that, which is adapting and validating social capital assessment tools for use in the developing country context. There are very few tools out there that measure social capital using, you know, that are theory-based. A lot of them are sort of afterwards, they think, oh, wait, this might be social capital that's going on here, which is fine, but thinking ahead of time, how do we measure if this is what's happening, and how do we actually validate those measures? And then lastly, thinking about sampling strategies that account for that multi-level effect, both at the community level and at the household level or individual level of social capital. That's just, those type of surveys and sampling are just not that prevalent in developing countries. So thinking about how can we contribute to that and build on that some more. So again, like I said, a lot of this comes, all of it comes from this this article. It is on the online program. You can download it there, or you can go to the Global Public Health website if you are interested. I'd also be happy to talk to you more about it in general. And just a few acknowledgments to those who funded me at the University of Michigan. This was part of my doctoral dissertation when I was at University of Michigan. Also at University of British Columbia, a social capital scholar, Richard Carpiano, gave me a lot of help with this, as well as my research assistant, Katie Janda. So that is all I have.